Welcome to Money, Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment and strategic decision making. If you're a fund selector, an independent financial advisor or an institutional investor looking for insights, analysis and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uester. Today is another episode of our underlying series, The Long Game, with investment strategist and Gibbs professor Adrian Saville. And today we're unpacking a deceitfully simple question. What gives gold its value? And what would it be worth if money itself changed? It's a conversation about market psychology and monetary faith, framed, as Adrian puts it, through the lens of poker and not chess. Adrian, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Ron.
Adrian, in one of your latest investment notes, you start with Joni Mitchell's song, The Circle Game, and I'm quoting
great
here.
Great song.
The painted ponies go up and down, we're captive on the carousel of time. What's that saying about markets right now?
A very short, powerful, punchy line from her fantastic song, but the reference, of course, is to, you know, the painted ponies is going up and down, you know, that, of course, in a point to cycles, the breathing in and out. And as we are recording this, hands are waving in the air. The gold price collapsed in the last 24 hours, you know, so there's a down. I'm quite confident there will be another up leg. There's two other things that are worth just, you know, pulling out of that fantastic line. The ponies are painted, and that's about illusion, mirages, hype, dupe, is really what you see, what you get. That's what it makes me think of. And then, you know, the carousel of time, the suggestion here is, well, if you go on a merry-go-round, you come back to the same place each time you go around. And, perhaps in many ways then, you know, investors need to have a sense of humor, because if we think of, in your intro, you made reference to gold. Well, here we are right back where we started, where gold was the most desired, admired, required to try and do some rhyming asset. There is an obsession with gold in human history. So if you think, you know, all the way back over hundreds of years, money is gold-backed. But in more recent times, the absolute obsession with gold in the 1980s, I'm certainly not suggesting in any way that we are at an obsession stage right now. But in the last 25, 30 years that I've been working in capital markets, I haven't seen this degree of interest in the single asset. And so, you know, this in many ways is a line from the song that is a perfect mirror of a psychology, investment policy and a philosophy.
You also argue in that investment note that markets look like chess but behave like poker. What does that mean in practice?
That sort of inspired or motivated by an article I read recently, you know, which suggests that very often, you know, the way that we are trained in investment management, the way we think about markets is, if A happens, then B. If you think of a chessboard, you can see all of the pieces. You actually know exactly where your opponent might be interest rates, your opponent might be the down cycle, your opponent might be a short player in a long market. But you can see all of the pieces. You know the exact parameters of the board. Uncertainty is absent. The only thing you have to work out is, you know, how will your opponent respond to your moves, and how many moves can you think ahead? If we, you know, go to investment management, this is referred to, you know, often as sort of second order thinking, that if you can think, you know, beyond the immediate and think what happens behind the curtain, you know, and that would be reference to thinking about the second or third move in chess. But poker is the information is hidden. You don't have access to all of the knowledge that your opponent has in chess. Your opponent sees cards that you can't see. And so you're being asked to make critical judgment calls with incomplete hidden information. And in many ways, if we work on the central subject of our conversation today, gold, the opponent that you're working with is actually the psychology in the rest of the market's mind. And, what is this market thinking? And so the challenge then is for us to try and read the odds and to infer beliefs, to try and make sense of really a sort of a cacophony of noise where the rules aren't straight, the moves aren't linear, and even if your opponent moves in a particular way, they castle. What they can do from there in our game of chess is they can do things that are almost unimagined. And to go back to a much earlier conversation that we had, Ruan, where we spoke about Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, in that book, there's actually a reference to the game of chess, but the way that you move squares is by taking a train. This is the fancy world of poker, the fantastic world of poker. It's the world of investing.
Well, that brings us to gold's most uncomfortable truth. It doesn't do anything. It's not productive. It's not industrial. So why does it have value at all?
Well, I mean, if I came into your office with a bag of gold, I think you'd be delighted. And a packet of Kruger coins on your table, you would be thrilled. And if we came back in 1,000 years, the Kruger coins would still be there. They will have done nothing and no one will have used them. So, exactly as you point out, gold has almost no industrial use. It is overwhelmingly a useless asset. But where its utility comes from is a combination of really just two things. The first is that it is scarce. It's hard to get hold of. So there is a very tiny amount of it, relative to other resources. So that gives it scarcity value, hard to find, hard to mine, hard to refine. And in its pure form, it is even scarcer. But then it becomes a store of value. No one's going to try and corrupt it through industrial use. The industrial use isn't going to cause spikes and collapses in its price. That might be useful or it might be unhelpful, but it really creates another form of purity that really the only thing that is driving the price of gold is our psychology, our behavior and belief. And if you and I agree that gold is scarce, and if you and I agree that it is valuable, then we might have something called an asset class. And so it is the central thesis in gold is that people want it because other people want it. And people believe that it is valuable because they believe that it is valuable. In one breath, that is an incredibly powerful attribute. And in another breath, it is terrifying.
So in essence, gold is the mirror of our own trust in money or governments, even in the system.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why you're seeing in recent times, the gold price has moved from $2,000 to $4,000 in a very swift way, overwhelmingly unanticipated. But it is it's a combination of anxiety, inverted commas, assaults on the Fed, fear about inflation that might jump out. If we look around the world at government balance sheets, they're increasingly stretched. Fiscal discipline is missing. And if you have stretched government balance sheets, if fiscal discipline is absent, now we get into the business of printing money, which makes money worthless. And the inverse of money being worthless is that whatever is measured in monetary terms will become worth more. In other words, it's going to take you more dollars that are worth less to buy an ounce of gold. So think of when the gold price goes from 2,000 to 4,000 in one part, the temptation is to say, oh, you know, gold has become more valuable. Perhaps not. It's that the dollar has become worth less and you need even more dollars to get that same ounce of gold, which is the exact same ounce of gold that it was 1,000 years ago. So it's psychology that's driving this.
Speaking of which, you've done the math on what gold would be worth under different currency systems, and the range is wild. Maybe you could just elaborate on that.
I had some fun doing this. I'm a student of economic history, and if we look at the broad sweep of time, gold has been in the background of money in various shapes and forms. But let's just use, you know, the relatively recent past, again, inverted commas, where through the 1800s, we had what was called gold-backed money. Now, you know, it wasn't quite 100% backed by gold, but, you know, for all intent and purpose, we can imagine, you know, that what governments had out in the market as issued money, they had that backed by gold sitting in a vault. Now, if we were to return money to that arrangement and we asked what would the price of gold have to be for all of the money in the world to be backed by gold sitting in government vaults, hang on to your hat, the price of gold is $100,000 an ounce. So moving from $1,000 to $4,000, it hasn't even cleared its throat. If we go to the Bretton Woods system, which was perfectly acceptable, but money was backed only in part by gold because now under Bretton Woods, you were allowed to use dollars also, then that would give us a gold price in the region of $20,000 an ounce. So, still, you know, spectacularly north of where we are now. So, if we imagine, you know, some disruption, distress in the global monetary system, then all bets are off in terms of current gold price. 20,000 or maybe even 100,000 could be the next stop. And, you know, before people sort of respond with, well, you know, this guy is crazy, it's worth remembering that there was a time when Bitcoin traded for a couple of dollars a coin, and here it is at $100,000. What drives this? A combination of scarcity and belief.
So depending on how much of the financial system you're backing, gold could be worth 10 times, 50 times, even 100 times its current level.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not making a prediction. You know, I'm just giving people, you know, who are listening in on us, a mental model for thinking about what's within the realms of possibility. Remember, we're playing poker, not chess.
So let's make that real. How much of the world's wealth is actually in gold right now?
That's a fascinating question. And if we, you know, if we take not, you know, every possible asset, but just, you know, large investable assets, when we talk about global equities, bonds, real estate, we gather up all of those assets together. We're talking about a couple of $100 trillion in each of these. So, you know, $300 trillion in public markets, equities and bonds, perhaps another $300 or $400 trillion in global real estate. And then if we take all gold that is above the ground, sitting on people's fingers, around their necks or in their vaults, and that includes official gold, it is a fraction of a fraction. That sum sits at about $16 trillion, but the official gold figure is just $3 trillion. So less than 1%. Sits in that store of value. And that then, Ron, creates, I think, an intriguing question is, you know, if only 1% is sitting in gold, what would happen if people decided, you know, en masse to nudge their allocation from 1% to 2%?
Yes, of course, a small psychological reallocation could change the price dramatically. So if gold's fair value is psychological, how should investors think about holding it?
Well, for a long time, it's fashionable in this moment to be talking about gold, but for a long time, I have held gold as a core part of my portfolios, my multi-asset portfolios. And you could think of this as a nuclear winter asset, because if the end of days come, one thing history suggests that people might still place a store of value in is gold. So, you know, I'm not making a prediction that, you know, we're on the cusp of some, you know, the sky is collapsing, but this is a small allocation of your portfolio to an asset that behaves differently and in an end of world scenario is going to be a phenomenal insurance, a form of insurance. How much do you hold? That really is how long is a piece of string type question. You know, some people will say 5% is enough. I have one client who actually holds 1/4 of their portfolio in gold and will not allow that 1/4 to go anywhere underneath 25%. And it's been this way for decades. Now, you know, I would put that at sort of the other end of the spectrum. In my mind, that's a big number. Where I've held gold in physical times, closer to 10% than the 5%, and that has turned out to be, you know, a really good position. And the way the gold price has moved, I'm tempted to take my 10 back to 5. But anything higher than that, you know, starts to feel like you are over allocating to this asset, because it's just psychology. And so, you know, I would make a similar argument then for Bitcoin. You perhaps, you know, perhaps somewhere in early single digits, for the sake of a number, 5% to those assets.
So in a poker sense, that's keeping chips on the table for when the next hand is dealt.
I love that.
So, Adrian, if you had to sum it all up, what does gold tell us about the world right now?
Well, you know, gold is telling us a couple of things. Gold is telling us all is not well, that there are some things to be concerned about. Now, you know, you and I have spoken at length in the past about the things that we could worry about. Is it trade tensions? Is it incursions on the independence of the Fed? Is it that tariffs are likely to inject inflation into the system? Our suspicion is that, you know, that number is heading higher as we finish the year. The world is fractionalizing politically, fragmenting politically. Tensions are going higher. So, you know, any one of these, I made reference earlier in our conversation to global indebtedness, public sector indebtedness, and the inability of especially developed market governments to pull in the reins on deficit spending. So there's any one of things to worry about, and we could choose what our favorite brow furrower is, but you know, if we put any one of those into the bucket, they're enough to cause significant market stress. And that's what gold is signaling. Gold is telling us there are reasons to be worried. And for that reason, it makes a powerful case to keep this as a small but central holding in your portfolio.
So we've come full circle from Joni Mitchell's carousel to poker tables to central banks. And it seems that the common thread is human behavior, isn't it, Adrian?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that I made the point earlier, you know, perhaps I'll make it in a closing observation also, is in one breath, psychology can be a terrifying attribute in investment decision making and behavior. But, you know, just like in poker, if we understand the psychology, if we understand the behaviors and the beliefs, the way the system works, then we can turn this into a very powerful asset, harnessing the psychology.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Adrian, for helping us unpack not just what gold costs, but why it's worth what it is and what that tells us about belief, currency, and human nature. We'll be back soon with another episode of The Long Game, exploring how long-term thinking can guide investors through shifting systems. I'm Ruan Uester, and this has been Money Markets and Masterminds, produced by Joe Lowe from the City Wire Studios team. You can find all our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and iono.fm, and of course, the City Wire South Africa website. And with that, until next time, goodbye.